All lines are now bridged.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the full information blocking task force meeting. We have a very tight agenda today, so I'm going to start with the roll call, and then we will turn it over to Andy for first for discussion on electronic health information export. Andy Truscott?
Present.
Michael Adcock?
Present.
Stephen Lane? Cheryl Turney? Denise Webb?
Present.
Sasha Toma?
Present.
Erin Meary? Valerie Gray?
Here, present.
Danielle Jane?
Present.
Cynthia Fisher?
Present.
John Kansky?
Here.
Lauren Thompson? And Denny McComb? Okay, thank you. I'll turn it over to you now, Andy.
Hi, this
call
is
my
Cheryl.
Name.
This is Arian.
Oh, hi. Hi, Arian. Thank you. Okay, floor is yours now, Andy.
Thanks so much. Hey, guys. Thanks for joining. We've got about an hour and a half together today, and there's two principal topics I'd like to touch upon, and this call is coming out of this week, and I'm sure the last thing you need on a Friday is to spend more time on information blocking, so we're going to spend more time on information blocking. We'd like to touch upon the EHI export and the functionality that's been discussed in another task force, and we're also going to have a walkthrough of the ONC thinking that led to the drafting of the regulations as they currently stand around information blocking. The purpose of these two sections is to be primarily in listening mode, although when it comes to the EHI export, I think we're going to allocate about 15 minutes just to understand that. We need to understand the touch points with the work that we're doing over in information blocking task force as well. And then for the second session, which is going to be led by Michael Lipinski from the ONC team, this is for us just to understand the work ONC has done and the thinking that they have pulled together and the balances and trade-offs that they've made against regulation, legislation that's gone before as they formed their positions, which are inside the regulations. That's not really for us to litigate through that and to overly discuss, but it's for us just to seek to understand their thinking and their reasoning to get there. Does that make sense, guys?
Yep.
Yep. Yeah. Cool. Okay. Magic. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to whoever it is, because I don't know who it is, who's going to be presenting on EHI export.
I think that's our topic, right?
I hope so, because it's definitely not me.
Okay, this is Denise. And I have not gotten the Adobe up, but in the recommendations that we provided from the Conditions of Certification and Maintenance Task Force, one of the recommendations that we're putting forth related to the EHI export, recommendation number 23 that we provided at the HITAC meeting, it says ONC should provide clarity around the scope of the EHI export. And our task force was recommending it be limited to EHI collected and retained by the certified EHR technology and apply only to the EHI that is part of the legal medical record. Narrowing to the legal medical record was important in particular for the scenario where research data may be stored in EHR. And so I know Sasha is on and she can also add some commentary on this, but we wanted to bring this up with the information blocking task force because as we look at the definition of EHI, And that's been a topic of discussion for, I believe it's the work group one of our information blocking task force. The definition of EHI as proposed in the rule is quite broad. In fact, it includes information that is stored in health IT that is not necessarily certified or required to be certified. And so we struggled with this and had quite a bit of discussion around the requirement to create an export function that exports information from other than certified technology. That's what we were grappling with. And we think that while the information blocking rule and requirements will require data providers, you know, health systems and so forth, to provide information to a patient or for an HIT developer to assist an organization that wishes to move to a different platform, to assist them with getting all of their data out, even if the data is in part of the system that is not a certified EHR module, that it was restrictive to say that this had to all be handled by this EHI export function. So I hope I'm being clear. On one hand, under information blocking, all the data must be provided, but the EHI export is specifying that this is how it will be provided, and we think it should only apply to certified technology and then the narrow definition around the legal medical record. So that's what we wanted to bring forth to this group, since this group is deliberating on recommendations around the definition of EHI.
Hey, this is Arian. Do you have a proposed definition of the term legal medical record? So I'm aware of a definition under HIPAA called the designated record set. What's the operational definition of legal medical record?
I'm going to let Sasha comment, or if any of our other task force members are on, but that would have been my interpretation of what we were speaking about, is the designated record set under HIPAA.
Yeah, Arian, in our conversation, the idea was that when a patient would request their record under HIPAA, the data set that they would get would be the legal medical record. That was sort of the nature of and tone of our conversation as we talked about it. If the language needs refinement, I don't know that our conversation was set on that term. The concept was the information that the patient is already entitled to receive under HIPAA should, of course, be provided. But there was concern about other types of information that might not be considered by some of the providers in our work group part of the legal medical record. And some of the examples that came up included a half-written note. If you have a half-written note and a patient says, export my electronic health information, providers were concerned that, well, the half-written note isn't complete yet. That's not sort of legally part of the record yet in their determination, and they didn't think that that was appropriate to export until it was completed. Similarly, there was concerns about research data, which would typically be not considered part of the legal medical record if it's part of a clinical trial, but that might be electronic health information and could certainly, of course, invalidate the study if exported.
Yeah. For me, it's just, I think some of these, we're struggling in information blocking with defining the applicability of the information blocking exceptions, in particular, the pricing exceptions to make distinctions between access to data and additional services that might be supplied above, up and above access to data. And when you trace it back, getting the definition of EHI correct is pretty critical. And where I guess where I struggle is we're introducing We're introducing a new term called the legal medical record. There's an existing term, which is the designated record set. And then there's the proposed definition of EHI. If you look at the definition of the designated record set, it includes payment and billing information. So it's really everything about the patient that's used for decision making. I think that definition would exclude half-written notes that aren't used for decision making. But I'm just trying to figure out, when we introduce a term called the legal medical record, is it the same? Is it coextensive with the designated record set? Where does it differ from the proposed definition of EHI? How do we provide guidance back to ONC that they can operationalize? Because I struggle with that.
Yeah, and Arian, just so you're aware, within Work Group 1, there is considerable discourse on similar lines going on around the EHI definition and what the recommended definition of that should be. And it's very similar sets of discussions to what we're having now based upon the applicability of EHI export. Yeah,
right.
It's a hoary one.
If you look at the definition of designated record set, it includes other records that are used in whole or in part by the covered entity to make decisions about individuals. I think that definition would exclude half-written, the half-written note issue.
And what about data related to research?
I don't know that it would exclude data related to research, and so I think this is one of those areas that might be a where prohibited by law. But there's an alignment between information blocking and the common rule that I think is a really important comment to the information blocking. There's a general, not really an exception, but information blocking says that information must flow except where prohibited by law, or I think that's the definition. And these are sort of gray areas. Does the research common rule and a study protocol, is that sufficient grounds to prohibit information flow, even if it's not a defined exception? It might be better to handle research as a defined exception than to exclude it from the record set. I don't know.
Yeah, Arian, a comment that's been made as well is that when you're looking at using HIPAA-type definitions, they were definitions created to place restrictions on data sharing as opposed to definitions created to enable information sharing.
I don't think that's correct. So the designated record set is the defined term that is the boundary for patient access. And it was intended to be fairly broad, as saying basically the patient has the right to access of anything that's used to make a decision about the patient.
Okay, hang on a second, Arian. John Kansky has raised his hand.
Asking for what, actually? Sorry, John.
Yeah, I think I just really wanted, first of all, I understand and support where Denise and Sasha are trying to go. I think that's, I'm glad they've worked on that, and I think the suggestion is completely rational. I also see, I think I'm agreeing with Arian, and just wanted to underscore that if it meets the purpose of what they're trying to achieve, I think the designated record set defined in HIPAA would be a convenient existing industry definition to use if it meets their purpose.
Okay. Thanks, John. Oh, Denise Webb.
Yeah, so this issue around the definition of legal medical record is important, but the other half of this is that of our recommendation is around the idea that it's only data that is collected, received, retained in certified technology that would be subject to the EHI export function. We're not saying that the other data collected in non-certified systems shouldn't be made available. What we're saying is that it can be made available by other means. But right now, we believe the ONC's rule is proposing that the EHI export cover all data as defined for EHI be made available to this export function, whether the technology is certified or not. And that's what we really were having issue with and why we came up with our recommendation.
Okay, what was the intent of the drafting? Does someone from ONC want to comment on that?
Well, so remember, it's the developer who gets certified. This is Mike Lipinski, ONC. It's the data that they electronically manage or store. So it's not. So they have. There has to be that piece to the puzzle as well, that to hold them accountable, the certified developer. It's not just every piece of information that's stored in by that healthcare provider. It's got to be the information. The reason why that is, as we say out in the rule, is because they would know the format that it was stored in, because they're responsible for it, and therefore they can provide the data dictionary to export that information.
So I just raised my hand. Hopefully it's okay if I speak. This is Denise. Now, just let's take a scenario here. If a health IT developer, such as one of the EHR vendors, provides as part of their integrated suite, the revenue cycle management portions of that, is that considered part of the certified EHR technology? And I'm talking, let's just speak in today's world. Is that part of the certified EHR technology and would be subject to the previous data export or this new EHI export? I mean, we were struggling with that because while demographic data and admissions might come from a registration system that is not certified, and then that data is available in the EHR, that certainly would be subject to export. But what about other data, such as billing data and such, that is sitting in a non-certified technology?
And
while it's managed by the developer that is a certified technology developer, that piece of their software is not a certified module.
Okay. So
good point. Arian,
just one quick.
Arian's got his hand up.
Yeah. So this is an interesting issue because the designated record set does include eligibility, billing, payment information that's used to make decisions about the patient. So provider organizations are already obligated to supply all of that information to the patient. So there's a provider obligation to make the data available. I think the issue that you raise is it reasonable for a particular certified health IT module that is being, so there's the intent here by Congress was a concern that EHR vendors, some EHR vendors were making it intentionally difficult to transition technology. And I think the intent here from Congress was to make it easy to transition EHR technology. And so I guess maybe two things to keep in mind that are maybe contradictory. Number one is the patient already has the right to all of that data, and it's a provider obligation to provide that data. Number two is I do think it's reasonable with respect to a certified health IT module to be responsible for the portion of migration that is relevant for the data that's being held by that certified health IT module.
Arian, do you think, so if there were a company that produced revenue cycle products, but no products that they would ever present for certification, then they wouldn't ever be subject to this export provision, even though the providers using that revenue cycle product would have to still comply with providing patients the designated record set, correct?
Yeah, so there's a provider. So the hooks in information blocking are to providers, which I think everyone is aware that the definition of provider is extremely expansive. And so there's a patient download obligation that's incumbent upon providers that's actually well aligned with the HIPAA designated record set. But then you're raising the issue about, well, what's the responsibility of any particular certified health IT technology? and they're responsible for a piece of it. So we're really delegating responsibility to the provider. I think under this proposal, we're delegating responsibility for the provider to be the one to pull it all together. But it's already a provider obligation under the designated record set capability or definition. But that's a slightly different time frame relative to 45 days and could be paper copies and all that. You know, these are the alignment issues that I think we're struggling with.
I'm struggling, I guess, with it seems like we have an expectation for all health IT, any revenue cycle system, for example, but it's only being imposed on health IT that happens to be developed by someone who also produces certified health IT. And I think there's a fundamental challenge there because some of the expectations will go unmet if the developer happens to not also produce any certified health IT. And it presents a competitive inequity for developers of certified health IT for their products that are not actually part of the certification program because the program is sort of inequitably applied across health IT modules that don't have any relevant certification criteria.
And if I can add to that,
nifty point.
I'm aware of, you know, I know we shouldn't use vendors' names, so I'm not going to use it. So there's a vendor that provides a totally integrated EHR, which also includes the revenue cycle management. But then they also, through acquisitions, acquired a revenue cycle management system, which the data exists in a totally separate database. And health systems can acquire the integrated EHR and choose to use the vendor's revenue cycle management product outside of the EHR. So you have a certified EHR, and then you have your revenue cycle management. They both have separate databases. If I understand what ONC is proposing on the EHI export, it would only be the EHR that is certified that would be subject to the EHI export requirements. The data
Ooh,
that is
no. No, that's not right. And I think no. Sasha's got this exactly right, which is that the information blocking provisions apply to developers of certified health IT technology, which I think Sasha's right, would cover all of the products produced by just one. Eating one taste is enough to get you hooked.
Okay, so you're just saying is if one vendor has several products and they're not all certified, but they're used together to provide service to treat the patient, then all of that data, whether they're in separate databases, would be subject to EHI export. So the export would have to work with both systems.
My understanding is that the way that the information blocking rule works is that it applies to developers of certified health IT technology, that you are a developer of certified health IT technology if you have at least one technology certified, but that the applicability of that definition is to the entity and not to the technology. And so Sasha's point is that any of the products of that certified health IT technology are covered under the export.
Okay, guys. Guys, I have to stop the conversation here. Okay. This is exactly the dialogue I wanted to make both task force aware of the sentiment that exists. We, you know, Sasha and Arian, we're going to have to look very hard about whether we want that definition because I think you're correct in what the current drafting is, and we are being asked to HITACH about whether we recommend any changes to that definition or not. And we need to work through that. I'm going to hand it back to Mike Dupinsky because he had a couple of comments to make upon this. And then I'd like to move forward into understanding, and I'm sure Michael touched back upon this as part of that understanding presentation, but also just to walk through the ONC thinking that has brought us to where we are. And Denise, thank you ever so much for bringing this to the fore from your task force. Is that okay?
Yes, thank you, Andy.
You're welcome. Sorry, cut the, we have time not on our side, but I think people understand the scope and the scale of the issue here and that we actually need to put some serious thought into these definitions. Mike, can we hand over to you?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to say, I don't know if folks maybe just overlooked it or didn't catch it, but I misspoke when I said, I think I used the word store, and I meant to say produces and electronically manages, so therefore, you know, they're producing the data in whatever format, proprietary format in some instances, so that is the rationale behind why they should be able to export it. So I'll just leave it at that. Did you want me to turn to the presentation on the terms at this point related to info blocking, or did you want to talk more about that?
No, I'd like to move forward because I'm conscious that we've got not a huge amount of time today.
True.
But okay. Actually, we've set this up so that Mike is prepared. He's not just going to present nonstop for an hour and we pepper him with questions at the end. Raise your hands and I will interject and we will get questions going as we go through this. Okay? Because it's important that we all understand across the task force the thinking that Mike and the team had as they brought this together. So please raise your hands and let us interrupt that way. Thanks.
Thank you, Andy. So I'm not sure who has, I think we'll be getting assistance here, so we can go to the next slide. Okay, we're going to try to give you a presentation. So the disclaimer, I think it does apply to anyone and everyone. So we can tell you what is consistent with what we said in the preamble of the rule. We can't do any interpretation beyond that. If you feel that something is unclear, ambiguous, or even just not the right policy, we obviously encourage comment on that. This is the part of the process, so I'm going to talk briefly about a little bit what we went through to get to this proposed rule, but then this is also part of that process before we get to a final rule, which is, you know, taking the public feedback here on the policies we're proposing. All right, so let's move on. Let's get into it. Okay, this is kind of what we're going to try to get through. A little bit of background, try to focus on the terms. If we can, we'll get to these two particular exceptions. We've heard that that's kind of, there's been some, you know, questions about clarity regarding them. So if we step forward, we'd be doing it straight. If not, you know, whenever we need to come back, we'll be happy to do so. All right, move to the next slide. So where did it all start? I can't say for sure this is where it all started, right? But in our ONCs, or Department's Fiscal 2015 Appropriations Act, Congress asked us to do a few things. One was to issue a report about how pervasive, you know, information blocking was, what a strategy would be to address it, and it focused on vendors, eligible hospitals, providers. So they were talking in terms of, at the time, the EHR incentive program, and that was kind of what that first bullet point was about. They wanted us to try to take some action that we could at that point, and you can see how they talk about how info-blocking frustrates congressional intent and devalues tax payer investment, and particularly, I think, over $28 billion in the EHR incentive program. So that was like late 2014, and then, you know, within that short period of time they gave us, we moved to the next slide, we issued a report to Congress. And so if you haven't read that yet, it's probably a really good thing to go back to and just take a quick look at. Unlike our rulemaking, it's about 1/8 the size. It depends on how you look at 1/10 if you double the pages and so forth. But it's only about 30-some late pages. Single space, though. So one thing I wanted to draw out from it here on the screen, just so you can get a sense and maybe just do a little bit of a comparison to what's actually in the Cures Act. So this was a definition we put forth in our report to Congress, and it talks about a lot of things you probably will see or have seen already in the Cures Act, about talking about interference with the access exchange in use, about a knowledge standard for those parties who are engaged in info blocking, and then about the unreasonableness of it and talking about how there are, you know, the need to balance certain public policy interests. And you can see there we listed out some of them. And this is almost, 4 years ago from today, about, you know, privacy, safety, security, and then obviously there's a legitimate economic interest, right, related to innovation. Okay, so I just wanted to kind of give you that little bit of background about it, where, you know, at least from our perspective, where we got started with this process. So In the time after that, we continued to engage stakeholders. We also did what agencies are sometimes asked to do, which is provide technical assistance to Congress on various drafts of bills that they're putting together. So we did all that, and then on the next slide, this happened. 21st Century Cures Act passed. And that was December of 2016. And in it included a comprehensive approach to addressing information blocking. So it has a definition. It talks about activities that were, could be reasonable that you could partake in that wouldn't be info blocking. Asked the secretary to identify those. Gave power for enforcement, primarily to the Office of Inspector General, to investigate claims, and in certain instances, it'll be on the next slide, give out civil money penalties. So we jumped a little soon. I'm sorry. You heard the word next slide. But that's okay. It's okay. We can move to that now because we'll talk all about some of this. There's complaint process too. So let's go then now to the next slide, definitely. So I thought this could be helpful to kind of just lay it out big picture. So you have the definition there and things to identify as who are the actors. The likely interference, right? So it's not saying they have to, it's a likely interference, which I think is important in how we perceive, how we interpreted the statute and provided our proposals. And then what you see there is all the elements of information blocking. So this is all this has to happen here, these steps before, you, whoever you are, actor, obviously, are an info blocker. So first you have to be a covered actor based on how that's defined. It's got to be EHI, based on how we define EHI. It's got to be a practice that interferes, right, or discourages or prevents that access, exchange, or use of EHI. Got to have the right knowledge standards, which differs between certain actors. And Congress put in the definition itself, if the law said don't share the information, then you can't be an info blocker. And then lastly, to be an info blocker, all that other stuff has to happen, and then what you're doing, your practice, isn't covered by one of the exceptions either we propose, and I should say finalize as well, right? Because that's what the comment period's for. So let's get into those elements now. So we can move to the next slide. Oh, sorry. There, I'll tell you a little more about those consequences, and I think these are going to be important when we talk about how we interpreted the statute and put forth our proposals. So penalties. As I was alluding to earlier, civil money penalties for developers, health information networks, health information exchanges, and developers, certified health IT. That is specifically from the statute, that wording you see there in terms of certified health IT. They have to be developers of that, and they have to be health information networks and health information exchanges. And then for healthcare providers, it leaves it to the Secretary of HHS to, through rulemaking, provide appropriate disincentives for those healthcare providers found to have information blocked by the Office of the Inspector General. So it's still the Office of the Inspector General that investigates that claim of information blocking and makes a determination whether or not that healthcare provider did indeed information block. So what have we done? In our rule, we, under our authority under the ONC Health IT Certification Program, are proposing a ban against developers who are found to information block. There's a condition of certification that allows them to, or doesn't allow them, ask them to attest that they don't info block. And then also we would publicly list that ban and then any terminations of certified health IT related to that information blocking claim. CMS, in their interoperability and patient access proposed rule that was released simultaneously with our rulemaking, they proposed a public report on clinicians and hospitals who don't attest that they don't info block. Double negative there, but that's their proposal at this point. But again, also in this rulemaking, we won't talk about it today, our rulemaking, to be clear, we have a request for comment on what would be appropriate disincentives related to information blocking, including whether their current approaches are sufficient in programs or whether there would be new disincentives needed to address information blocking. So just want you to be aware of that. That's a request for information and comment on behalf of the entire department, not just ONC. Moving on now. Next slide. Okay, so that first, let's talk about that first element, the actors. Four of them specified in the Cures Act. We provide a definition for each of them. Let's just jump right in. Next slide. Healthcare providers. So here it is, just kind of in a bulleted form. I want to make you aware that, and maybe we could just quickly do this for folks. It doesn't necessarily have to do it, actually. So at the end of this deck is an appendix, and it provides the, it starts on slide 31. It provides a definition of healthcare provider as found in the Public Health Service Act. It includes a bunch of cross-references to other parts of the Act and other acts in some cases, about what those, how you should interpret those terms. So we included, I think it's slide 32 through 39, a table that kind of helps provide more specificity to some of these terms you see on the screen. So for example, what is a covered entity? So we lay that out for you in those slides. What entities are covered, for same with practitioner. So a practitioner is like a clinical nurse specialist, a clinical social worker, psychologist. I think also of important under that covered entity, it gets into state and municipality run hospitals are covered as well. A hospital definition is also quite broad. So just want to make you aware of all that. We're also requesting some comment on whether we should focus more on the HIPAA definition, which is gets into more the furnishing of services or billing for medical services and in terms of how it covers healthcare providers. So I'll take a breath and tell you why that definition of healthcare providers. So what the Cures Act did is it amended the Public Health Service Act. So then we look to the Public Health Service Act. Does it have a definition of healthcare providers? It does. And where did that definition come from? That definition came from the HITECH Act. So the HITECH Act amended the Public Health Service Act in the same, almost in the same way the Cures Act did for the same section, the health information technology, the title, I should say. And so that there's a definition, that definition that we're using was provided through the HITECH Act and then as further amended via the Cures Act. So you'll see that same issue come up with health information when we start talking about EHI. Health information, which originally started for purposes of HIPAA through the Social Security Act, that was brought in through the HITECH Act as well and applied to that same section. So, you know, that's when we get to that, we'll talk about that. But that's how we got to this definition. So we're obviously taking comment on it. We'd be happy if, you know, what we provided so far doesn't provide enough clarity to these various terms to provide that, you know, via comment, and finalizationable. But we wanted to make sure, there was, cause in the actual rule itself, it just talks to the cross-reference, to healthcare provider definition in the Public Health Service Act, but I think hopefully this gives you a better sense of why like that definition, because HITECH is what amended the Public Health Service Act to put it in, and then further amended by the Cures Act. So I want to just stop for a second. I feel like I've been talking a lot, and I appreciate that. Is there any questions about this, anything today before either some of the background or on this particular definition? And everybody can hear me, right? I think so. I see them transcribing it. So yep. I think I'm okay in that regard. Great. No, thank you.
I do have one question, which is, I saw that Congress noted that the penalty is to the developer of certified health IT. And maybe you'll get into this, but the way that the definition of applicability of information blocking goes is that it's applicable to the entity that is the developer of certified health IT, and I'm having a hard time just like looking at the intent of Congress and then the proposed language. So maybe when you get to that section, you can comment on that.
Yeah, I didn't want to spend because we don't talk extensively about principles of any type of statutory interpretation in the rule, so I have to be careful of that. But there are a lot out there that are common. looking at the whole act, avoiding surplusage, I should say it that way. So which means really that you're giving each word or phrase meaning, and you want to avoid interpretation that would make any other words or phrases either redundant or meaningless. So that comes into play too. It's all terms such as processes, I should say, such as knowing what it means by from its association, how it's been used throughout the act or section of that act in particular, things like that. We were looking to when we specialize meanings of words as well versus an ordinary meaning. These are all things you're supposed to look at when you interpret a statute, and which we applied in this case. One thing about legislative intent in history, I'll just speak for myself. So this is just Michael Tinsley speaking. You usually don't look at legislative intent unless it's there, and it's usually only there in committee reports, which there weren't. Sometimes you can rely on past versions of the bill to understand that. There are committee hearings, so we do cite to some of them, like, for example, when it comes to the communications provision and the gag clauses. But unfortunately, in this case, and there wasn't much legislative history to look at. So to note that when you're talking about legislative intent, but usually, there are approaches of how you interpret, statutes outside of that. Okay, I think we can go to the next term. Probably, I think we'll open up one for debate based on the comments I've heard. So this is our definition of a health IT developer, a certified health IT. So I think, as Aaron mentioned, the provision, as the definition goes, of information blocking doesn't say health IT developer of certified health IT. It just says health IT developer. But back to some of the things that I mentioned earlier in terms of how we interpret the statute, and we actually are pretty specific about this in the preamble, we look at the other provisions. So most importantly, a provision that we looked at is, and this is in the actual same section 4004, is how enforcement. So how would this be enforced? The enforcement says that the Office of Inspector General can only investigate a claim for that a health information technology developer of certified health information technology or other entity offering certified health information technology either submits a false attestation under the conditions of certification or engages in information blocking. It also says they can only investigate a healthcare provider engaged in information blocking or, specifically again, a health information exchange or network engaged in information blocking. There's also actually another provision that talks about the reliance on health information technology or developers and their certified health IT and not holding a healthcare provider or penalizing them, holding them liable, so to speak, if that developer or entity didn't meet the requirements of certification. So contextually looking at it, and our approach was to interpret health information technology developer consistent with that provision although we don't talk about an alternative, but let's say it was, we didn't do it that way, there would be no enforcement against any developer that didn't certify. Nobody could investigate them for information blocking if you had a broader definition under the statute, at least. So we did all make clear, and I think I heard in discussions earlier that folks understand that, that it isn't limited, to just their certified health IT, and we talk about why we reached that conclusion, and, for example, how providers are treated in the section, how HINs are treated, that they're not limited to the tech. The examples provided in the Cures Act aren't specific to only certified health IT in terms of giving examples of information blocking. So bottom line is, if a developer certified a product, they would be subject to the information blocking provision for any actions, not just actions with their certified health IT, but any actions that would constitute information blocking under our proposals. We do talk, though, about a temporal nexus. I think that's important. So was the action, did the action occur while they were a developer certified health IT? So for example, we say like, if you would have came in, got a product certified, maybe you don't sell your product, you decide, you know, this is me anymore, I want out of the program. And so, you know, 5 years later, somebody tries to allege you're an info blocker. We don't think that was in, you know, what was intended by the statutory provision. So we didn't interpret it in that way. However, the one instances that we were concerned about and we talk about in the rule is if I'm a developer of certified health IT, you know, maybe I get wind of an allegation against me. So I withdraw or, you know, or my product's terminated, comes in, that they should still be held accountable. So that's why if it's an allegation while they were one is important. But also, what if they, we posited that, what if they dropped out of the program, but then wouldn't release the information? So then, so for example, the export situation, we've received, you know, we talk about comments and information from stakeholders received about concerns about that, quote, holding the data hostage. So we wanted to make sure that those type of situations wouldn't occur. So we've, you know, there's two different options we've kind of thrown out there. It's not the only options. We're definitely looking for comment on this, but how we could hold developers still accountable in those situations. So whether we should require for a period of time you're still accountable for the information, or if you continue to store or control the information, the EHI, you should still be accountable. So wanted to mention that. So that's, you know, we feel like we've laid that out quite clearly in the rule, all different interpretations related to this definition. I'm still wondering if there's any questions as to that.
Is there a definition of the term entity?
There is not a definition. So that, you know, arguably could be plain meaning. We do define an offer of health IT is, so that is actually in the preamble section, what would constitute still offering the health IT. So, like, for example, if, like, there were third parties offering certified health IT or you sold it or something of that nature, you know, you get it. You're a developer, you get it certified, but then you sell or license the ability to offer the information, or excuse me, the health IT. So we do address that in the from a coverage perspective in
Mike.
The preamble. Yes.
Hey, Mike, we do refer to organization or individual or entity and individual at various places.
Right. Yeah, so the individual entity is straight from the statute. That's used throughout the statute, so we kept it individual and entity in that regard.
So is it fair to interpret?
But even like we call them all developer, like from our perspective, they're still a developer of certified health IT. So we've created that term that encompasses them, including the offerer as well.
Okay, cool. Arian, have you got an additional question?
Nope. Sorry, that was my question.
Oh, okay. Oh, Jeanette.
Is there a distinction between developer and self-developer?
So we actually asked, there's a part of the, I'm not sure who that's been assigned to, which work group, but we asked questions about that.
They should be treated differently. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we've laid that out pretty clearly. I don't actually have that in front of me. I could pull it up, but I'll do my best from my top of my head recollection on that. But we were definitely concerned about, you know, who are they acting as at the time? Are they acting as a developer? Because really, to be a developer, you have to offer it or sell it to someone else. But they are so normally they should be, and I think we proposed treated as a healthcare provider. However, the uniqueness of that is they're still coming through the certification program. So then the conditions of certification apply to them. So we've asked, you know, how, you know, best to reconcile that, or if there is really any need for reconciliation regarding that. In terms of application, whether they're, for example, do you think that certain conditions should not apply to them?
Right. And I know you probably can't respond to this, but maybe something for the task force members to think about. So if a self-developer decides to withdraw from the program and they're a healthcare provider, it's their users that are using the system. I'm trying to figure out how there could be, a claim of information blocking. I don't know, of their own providers.
Yeah, Denise, and this is an area that when we come back out of the work groups into the full task force, we'll be directly considering. It touches on work group one and work group three actually both have impacts upon this. Understanding the purpose of this is to understand the context by which ONC has used the ACTA definitions to structure the regulation. But I think we are going to have on that. Okay, Michael, back to you.
Sorry.
That's nice.
Yeah. And I think we are going to treat them like we propose to treat them as a healthcare provider, but I think you're raising the issue if they withdraw. So let me think about that some more and provide that, see if there's something further we can clarify for you on that one. I'll talk with some of the other folks who are supporting that. Okay.
You've got 27 minutes.
I think it's going to even get, we'll see. Next slide. We have, I think, health information networks.
I'm sorry. It's Aaron. I had my hand raised. I do want to ask a quick question on the previous slide. I'm sorry.
Sure.
I'm going to ask one more question around the developer question side there as related to a provider organization. To the degree that a provider organization wants to commercialize a product and it's still part of the provider, in my case is a university, it's now a commercialized product, but it's still under the university, it's still under the academic medical center side, but it is commercialized, so potentially is a JV or whatever else, where does responsibility held there? We do this today, by the way. So how is that enforced?
So I think you definitely could be considered a health IT developer of certified health IT if you're offering it, you know, commercialized. When you say, I assume what you mean by commercialized, you're selling it or licensing it.
Correct.
So it would depend on what the allegation was, right? Because you're a healthcare provider. Was the allegation related to your use of that health IT? That health IT itself, how you'd be treated. But so that's, you know, as we said throughout the rule, it's very specific, and it started from, you know, the congressional report. We even said the same thing that, but the point, I think the most important point, and we'll talk about that a little bit right here with, we get to in, you change a couple things when it comes to the, you know, the quote unquote prima facie case, your knowledge standard changes, and also you're subject to civil money penalties if you end up being treated as a health IT developer of certified health IT. So that's what we, you know, most wanted to get across in terms of awareness for, you know, somebody such as you situated, and if you have comments related to that. But the allegation would go to what were you acting as the time? Were you a health IT developer at the time and read the allegation, or were you acting as a healthcare provider? And that's the same thing with a HIN, and we give that example in the role. Were you acting as a HIN in the role when the allegation of information blocking came across, or were you just simply acting as a healthcare provider and providing the information to, you know, another healthcare provider?
Got it. Thank you.
Cheryl Turney's got her hand raised as well. Cheryl.
Thank you, Andy. So where do you see payers that have tools that they make available that are, you know, bought by employer groups and others? They have consumer transparency tools, and we have other tools that we utilize. Some communicate directly with the member, and others communicate directly with our providers. Where do you see that falling in this?
So I think you said payer you started off with, right?
Yeah.
And then you said payers who commercialize, I think, health IT, it sounded like, tools is what you probably meant, right?
Okay.
I can answer it only in terms of the definitions, which are, did you get that product certified? Are you a developer of certified health IT now, technically, or are you functioning as a health IT information exchange or a health information network? So that's if you want to ask for further clarity about a specific exit situation and whether, you know, this entity is functioning as a health information network, I would recommend you make that as a comment on the rule. I'm sorry, that's probably not exactly what you wanted. I'm sure you're looking for some type of information one way or another, but that's what I can give you right now. We
appreciate the regular process and the fact that you can't give that kind of interpretation at this point. Do you want to move on? Thanks, Cheryl, though. It's a good point, and we are going to discuss that in work group and task force.
Okay. All right, so next slide. Health information network. So as I was saying, we looked at it in terms of how the end functioned. And we, again, networks, we interpret, I think it's important to say health information networks. We took that from the context of in which that term was used. Again, as I said, we look at the Inspector General authority and ability to enforce, and they use the term health information exchange or network engaged in infoblocking. The term health information network is used in Title 4 in two other sections, coordinated sections, I'll call them. The Trusted Exchange and Common Agreement Health Information Network is used throughout. And also actually in reference to the Health Information Technology Advisory Committee, it talks about a role related to health information networks. So that's how we landed on Health Information Network. Instead of just network. And the definition we've consistent with the functionalities that we're familiar with related to health information networks. And I think a key point called out here is it has to be between two or more unaffiliated individuals or entities. And affiliated is, obviously that's open to comment. And so this goes back to what I talked to earlier on about giving meanings to every term. And so we had to make sure we interpret this in a way that it didn't subsume all the other terms, and then those terms would be meaningless, right? So like if it was, overly broad, you pull in all the other, like a normal healthcare provider exchanging with another healthcare provider. So hence you're facilitating exchange between two or more unaffiliated. So it isn't just you as the in and one other entity, because that could argue that's healthcare to whoever exchange, one-to-one exchange all the time. So it's you're providing either the technical infrastructure or you're controlling through policies the agreements and how that exchange occurs over a network that could be a third-party network. So we talk about that example in the rule where a large healthcare provider could create an entity even in an area, use a developer's health IT to provide the functionality of the exchange. But if they're the one who is substantially influencing how that exchange occurs, under what policies it occurs, then they can be considered a health information work. And again, as I was talking to you earlier, the importances of that is it changes the knowledge standard for them and what they're subject to from a penalty perspective. So that, is our proposal related to that. Is there any questions about that? Not that whether you agree or disagree with it. I mean, again, that's the comment period, but
yeah, I mean, another question.
What we're doing here. Okay.
Yeah, so when I chase these definitions down between EHI and health information network, I conclude that organizations like banks are health information networks under the rule, at least to the extent that they supply, or at least the sub-portions of their businesses that remit payments back to providers that are where the payments are associated with a claim or remittance that has an identifier that's tied back to a patient. The logical thought process, let me just posit this. The logical thought process that I use is that a health information network is sending or controlling the sending of through policies and procedures. The electronic health information, which is defined as information relating to past, present, future condition, provision of service or payment, and that the data has to be identifiable or could be identifiable. And when I spider out those definitions, the conclusion is that there's a broad range of activities that fall under the health information network definition. And I wonder, with respect to at least the way that the definition is laid out, or with respect to preamble, if there's any clarification of organizations that are very clearly not health information networks, and organizations that are where the intent is to make them health information networks. Because when I mention this, I think people get confused to why I would think that, and I get confused to why people would get confused to why I would think that.
So I think maybe I got myself and one of them confused. Can you explain more how they are either provide network of exchange between, let's say, the patient and the provider, or how they're influencing the exchange between the patient and the provider? If they're just a stopping point, like information goes from point A to point B, and then point B gives the information to point C, that is not, at least in our definition, controlling the sharing between C and A. Provide technology for C and A to exchange.
This is an interesting distinction. So if I'm a bank and I remit payment from a payer to a provider, and I manage the information, which is, you know, the payment identifier, the change of money, but also the identifying information associated with that payment. I would think, providing a service that facilitates the exchange of EHI between two or more unaffiliated individuals and entities. That's where I get the definition. I hear you. I'm just trying to understand the definition and where the boundary points of the definition are, so that I can understand whether I'm dancing angels on heads of pins, or whether there's a breadth of the definition that may be unintended.
Okay. I don't know if I have any more of an answer for you at this point on it.
Okay, I hear you.
But like, other than what I said, yeah. So it's really like focusing. It's those two on. You're affecting the exchange between those two unaffiliated. I wish we had put. I have good examples that we did not put in the rule, and so I think you're just at this point. I should say you should comment on that.
Got it.
And Arian, this is Elise Anthony. Yeah, I agree with Mike. I think that, you know, our goal in definitely having you review these are to tell us whether we struck the right balance, right? Are they appropriately inclusive, overly inclusive, or not inclusive enough? So I think what I'm hearing from you is that you may have some concerns about the appropriate inclusivity and whether the definition we have here works. So that would be a great place for you to comment. And then when that comes in, we can consider that.
Awesome.
And
thank you.
Arian, we can definitely do that through the work group as well. But we are looking at that. So you can open the Google Doc and you and I can pick on it, and you can do it as part of the task force. So absolutely.
Cool. Thank you.
Mr. Kansky, you have your hand raised in eager anticipation.
Yes, how did you know? A rhetorical question and an actual question on that conversation. The rhetorical question is, how would a reader, and I think you're going to say, well, yeah, that's what we just said, John, so you should comment. How would a reader of this rule as written, with the definitions as written, not come to the same conclusion that Arian would? It's my rhetorical question. My actual question is, I want to make sure I understood that particular point because it seemed really, really important to my understanding of the rule, is if a bank is moving information that's defined as EHI between a payer and a provider, and a health information exchange is moving information between a provider and a provider, why is a health information exchange not a bank? Not a bank, but why would we not overlay that same interpretation on the health information exchange?
That's a good question, and one which we will take forward.
Yeah, I don't know if this will help, but like, so it's who, you need an allegation of information blocking, right? So who is info blocked, right? So let's say in this case you're saying, I guess, the bank, but who did I request the information from? So did I request the information from the healthcare provider, or did I request the information from the bank? You understand? So like, it's they're controlling or overseeing the policies of the exchange between those two or more unaffiliated providers. So I'm not if I'm requesting it from the hospital and somehow it has to run through the bank to get to me, and that bank determines, you know, how that exchange happens, then I kind of see more what you're saying, but I'm not quite sure how I'm following otherwise. You know, like, or the bank provided the tech and said how the tech had to be used for that exchange, because remember, it's the exchange between two unaffiliated entities. So, you know, you're controlling how they access the information. It isn't like, I'm a pediatrician, and I request the information from an urgent care hospital that where my on behalf of my patient who was sitting there. Similarly, then I go see my patient. Now goes from my pediatrician to the orthopedist, and the orthopedist requests the information from the hospital. The same, and this gets a duplication of X-rays and so forth. But like, they request it from the hospital, so it's still a one-to-one request for my information. So that hospital is a healthcare provider. Did they not give them that information and potentially are an info blocker, and for whatever reasons they didn't give it to the orthopedist? Same approach with the pediatrician. Let's say then the orthopedist requests the information from the pediatrician because they want some more information, they want their notes too, over the network that the healthcare provider provides. So now, if he's not affiliated with either one of those, the hospital, they are now facilitating the exchange technically, maybe they're even doing through policies, between two unaffiliated providers, and therefore they could be seen as a HIN if somebody then alleged they blocked the sharing between those two. But see how there's like a where the request is going to? So it's a one-to-one request, and then it's a request between two unaffiliated, either through policies established by that third party, which is the HIN, or across their own network, that HIN's that healthcare provider hospital's network, the exchange.
And should I be able to understand that from reading the preamble, or where would I? Because that makes sense.
So the example we give is about a large healthcare provider in there, but it's more focused on them substantially influencing the exchange through their policies, and therefore they're going to be treated as a HIN. But it's still two unaffiliated parties exchanging over through an entity. It's similar. Like, it's through an entity. So in this, the example in the rule is they develop in an area, a third party, like they decided to establish this HIN or this whatever, an entity. What we were trying to show there is about the fact that they were the part about substantially influencing. So they establish this third party, and then this third party, which, you know, most folks would call a HIN, it permits the exchange between those two affiliated parties in the area. And so there we focus more on the healthcare provider being substantially influencing how that entity controlled that exchange, and therefore they could still be considered the HIN, even though this was this other third party. And it wasn't actually the healthcare provider who was doing technically the setting the policies. They were influencing the policies. But it's similarly the same thing in terms of like the unaffiliated. Like we talk about there being not, it didn't need to be a certain amount of nodes, you know, between for it to be a network. It just had to be between two at minimum, two unaffiliated parties that they were supporting the exchange, either through their how they either administered it, the policies and agreements, or how they did with the tech itself. I think, hey, you know, I would welcome comment. I think, you know, that's what we were back at. Like, if this is not clear enough, or it's not the right policy even, you know, that's what we may hear back about this. So I really just encourage comment in on that point.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
But, yeah.
Back on.
All right. Next slide, I think, is health information exchanges. Okay. So again, going to that, giving each term meaning, right, and so that they're not redundant or give another term making it meaningless. We look to define health information exchanges different than obviously how we defined an HIN. I think we relied on both context, our common understanding of this very specialized term, you know, based on, well, you know, having overseen a grant program and so forth related to HIE and so forth. And then we give examples of how we interpret this, both the definition and then how we interpret. So we talk about how it could be a RIO, a state health information exchange. So there again, you see states being identified as potential, you know, info blockers, as well as I told you the example with the hospital. And we even talk about how it could even be either a clinical data registry or so forth, because if it's, you know, scoped on a particular class of participants or a purpose. So I don't have much more to say on this one. I mean, we're pretty, so.
We've got 6 minutes before we go to public comment. Mike?
Oh, pardon me, I didn't catch that. Would you want to go to the EHI, you said, or?
No, you have 6 minutes before we go to public comment.
Oh, six. Oh, you're telling me how much time. Okay. Well, if there's no questions here, I can move to the next one.
Move on, please.
EHI. So again, back to what I initially said, health information, that definition is part of like the section of the Public Health Service Act, both amended by the High Tech Act and the Cures Act. So we started there. Definition talks about, you know, pretty broad, whether it's oral, recorded, any form or medium. But it talks about who did it and received it, whether it's a healthcare provider, plan, public health authority, employer, life insurer, school, university, healthcare, clearinghouse. And then the second part talks about how it relates to the past, present, and this is what you still see in our definition, future physical or mental health of condition of an individual, the provision of healthcare to the individual, or the past, present, or future payment for the provision of healthcare to an individual. So what we did here is we focused on the information itself and how it relates to the individual, not on who created or received it, knowing, because at this point it only mattered whether one of the actors covered by info blocking had the information or not. So within that in mind, one clarification we made was that it could include, we proposed that it could include information from an individual, but similarly it could include information from a device, from a school, from any other entity if it's in the possession of one of the covered actors of information blocking. The other thing we did was we can move to the next slide. We're clear that we do include PHI, and so just so you're clear what PHI is, it really is individually identified health information. And in a work group discussion yesterday, one of my colleagues, Morris, was trying, I think it got lost about what he was trying to say if you use that definition, protected health information, since it's just specific to individually identifiable health information, is the fact that the individually identified health information definition focuses on who created or received it. So then it would be limiting to only information that was created or received by a healthcare provider, a health plan, an employer, or healthcare clearinghouse. The rest, you know, is similar in terms of it identifies the individual, that it's related to those past, present, future pieces. But it would be more limiting because it would be focused on who actually created or received the information. So we do include that protected health information as part of our definition, to be clear. But we are broader, as I think it's probably clear to everyone right now. The last piece, two pieces, are that we excluded de-identified, which, you know, consistent with the HIPAA provision there, 164.514, which talks about how you would de-identify, what is the definite data and how you would go about de-identifying the data. And then last, we made it clear that the payment information, that would include price information as well. So that was our approach to defining EHI. The statute, neither as amended by the Cures or HITECH, has a definition for quote-unquote electronic health information, but it does have a definition of health information, also the same definition that's in the Social Security Act for purposes of HIPAA. All right, so don't think I have much more to say on EHI. I could talk about the price transparency piece, but I don't know if you want me to stop here first.
Oh,
okay,
please carry on.
Let's go. All right, next slide. Oh, I'm so sorry. I forgot this slide. So this talks about, gives you a better example of some stuff that we think is EHI. So you'll see that about additional information that could be considered EHI. So we tried to be, again, I talked about the price information piece, but all the other information that we believe could be EHI. We do, although, have a section of the preamble talking about, for lack of a better term, focus on observational health information. So this is the clinical information used for the care of the patient. And we focused in, when I say focused, we tried to emphasize that, you know, information blocking concerns would be pronounced when conduct involved that. But simply it could be, as we said there, in that part of the preamble, when it involved price information too. So nothing is precluded, so to speak, but, you know, noting here a strong concern about observational health information. All right, next slide.
Thanks, Mike. Actually, this is probably a good cadence point to go
okay.
to public comment,
sure.
please.
Okay.
Sure.
Operator, can you please open the public line?
Certainly. If you'd like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue, and you may press star 2 if you'd like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thank you. I know we have a number of public members joining us today, so we'll give them a minute to dial in. I just want to circle back to the roster. Have we been joined by either Stephen, Lauren, or Denny? Okay.
I believe Stephen's actually on vacation. He was leaving on a plane early this morning.
Okay. Thanks, Andy.
All right.
Operator, do we have anyone dialing into the public comment?
Not at this time.
Okay. Mike,
okay.
do you have a how many more slides do you have? You still have
you're talking to me. Actually, a lot of it is appendix, but there is, you know, there's a couple slides. I mean, obviously, we have the exception slide, but as far as I go, we have just the price information one in terms of definitions and the interoperability element. After that, it's really more back to the other elements of info blocking, such as what do we mean by, you know, interfere with access exchange of use, some examples of what practice could implement,
so
and then the knowledge standards.
Whilst we're waiting for public comments, can you go and talk through the price information, please?
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah, because I think I could probably offer some clarity there for folks on
one more quick check from the operator. Any public comments?
We have none at this time.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Next slide, then. So price information. So we have a section, like I said, I've alluded to a few times, our interpretation of payment in future for payment, right, that includes price information. We have an extensive discussion in there about why we find it to be problematic, not knowing the price information, how we think it could improve both competition and and lower the cost of care in the market. And we on behalf of the secretary and the department, extensive questions for the public about how we should capture that information, what information we should capture, can it be technically captured, and what the department could do to make that information more transparent. We also talk about how it relates to information blocking, too. So I want to make sure a clarity and distinction between that, because we talk about how we have a unique role in setting the stage for such future actions by establishing the framework to prevent the blocking of price information. And so we've asked about what are the parameters related to price information in terms of its scope as part of EHI. So I just wanted to touch on that quickly. So if there's no questions, we can go to another slide, I think.
Sure.
Okay, maybe there is.
Nope, no questions.
Okay.
Carry on.
All right, interoperability element. So as you can see, I think this slide is pretty much as self-explanatory as almost everything that we say in the preamble about this. So, you know, we were looking at trying to make sure we capture anything that would lead to the ability to access the EHI. And so that's important, particularly when it involves intellectual property rights or other rights that may need to be licensed to to get to the information. And that comes into play particularly with the exception we provided. So on RAND terms, so reasonable and non-discriminatory terms of licensing. So, you know, Mark could talk about that and maybe in the appropriate work group. I know we don't have time today. But generally speaking, like, Congress didn't provide any type of exception to sharing of information based on IP, intellectual property rights. They didn't say, oh, you don't have to share it if you have intellectual property rights. But we know that's important regarding innovation in the development of new products. And so while we still want to make sure there's access to information, the balance here is that we would ask that that whatever needs to be licensed to the intellectual property rights are done on RAND terms. And RAND terms take into account things such as the novelty of the product that has the IP in it or the technology in terms of deciding what is appropriate, you know, price for a license, so to speak, or royalty. So I won't say much more about that, but that's, you know, the purpose of that, I think, is we've tried to make pretty clear why we think you know, the definition of interoperable element and why, how that relates to some of the exceptions. Next slide, because I think I could at least get through this. So access, exchange, and use, we try to define those terms so that, and again, we looked at HIPAA here. They're not dispositive, but we tried to be aligned with that. You may catch certain, you know, like there's how we define it, but like, you know, actually we say read, write, and modify when it comes to use. So I don't really have much more to say about this one. We can move to the next slide. So these are just some of the practices that we thought, you know, could implicate the provision. And it's important to note there that it doesn't necessarily violate it. And let me just go to the next slide so I can talk about why that's true. Because you need to do that. There are certain things that have to also be met, going back to that prima facie case, whether or not you actually violated the information blocking provision. So you have to have knowledge. If you're a healthcare provider, you have to know that what you did was likely to interfere and that it was unreasonable. So that goes back, if you remember, the congressional report. In some respects, we talked about it being unreasonable, and I think that's also the reason why you have those necessary and reasonable activities Congress asked for us to identify. But comparatively, if you're a developer of certified health IT, a health information network or a health information exchange, and this also was, we noted in the congressional report to Congress, it could be simply you should have known that the practice is likely to interfere. So you don't actually have to know. It's more of like from a so this is like mens rea in legal terms in criminology and so forth. So like it's more of a gross negligence like type of approach. You should have known just to get as a comparative analogy. So just wanted to identify that difference as part of one of the elements. And we can go to the next slide. So required by law, Congress, in specifically in the definition, talks about how if it's required by law not to share the information, then you're not an information blocker. And we give an example in the rule to that. There's a certain privacy under the privacy rule that permits the not sharing of information and essentially is required by law. So that's, and I want to make clear, and I'm sure this has been talked about before, but like it's different than like normal privacy, the HIPAA, which is really disclosures are, I mean, for lack of a better term, permissive. Certain conditions have to be met before the information can be exchanged. For example, most of the time it's consent and authorization. And so that's, you know, from an info blocking perspective, we don't see it that way. The information should be exchanged, and you should have policies in place to meet those conditions. Not the lack of the condition means I didn't share it. So that's why we say you should be having organizational policies when we talk about the privacy exception and how you're going to fulfill any conditions, whether it's through the privacy rule or through a state law that requires certain things to be in place before that information can be shared. And I think that pretty much takes us to exceptions at that point. So next slide would be exceptions. So that's the last.
And Mike,
you know,
It actually completely takes us to time as well.
Great. Okay. Well.
Well, not great.
I am so comfortable getting through that. So.
what I would like to suggest, Mike, if you can, because you possibly join us at 2:30 on the Workgroup 2 call, and actually work through these at the beginning of the call.
Okay. I was actually going to let Mark talk about these exceptions, but I can check my schedule and see if I can join.
Hey, if you're happy to let Mark loose on it, that's fine too.
Okay.
Okay. You guys sort it amongst yourselves.
Okay.
Is there any final questions from the task force as we go into the sunset of the call? Nope. Great. Okay. Thanks ever so much for joining us. Members of the public, thank you very much for joining us as well. Lauren, I think we're good to adjourn.
Yes, we are. Thanks, everyone.